Hello, my name is Tinatin Japaridze. I am currently serving as the Director of Policy and Strategy at the Critical Mass in Virginia, in Alexandria, Virginia, but I myself am based in Washington, D.C., although I was a longtime resident of New York City, where I moved about 17 years ago now. Feels like longer, actually. I am originally from Georgia, and unfortunately, one of sort of the side effects of the sorts of situations that we are in right now in the region with the ongoing war in Ukraine, especially after the war in my native Georgia in 2008, I had to stop clarifying that I'm from Georgia, the country, rather than Georgia, the state. And that question was asked less and less after the 2008 war. And I think, if anything, that is the only positive of that war and its aftermath. But I am living and working in the United States. However, I have kept very closely in touch with my native country, with the region as a whole. And as you can imagine, and I'm sure this is true for many of you, that the ongoing war in Ukraine is absolutely devastating. And it couldn't have hit home closer as it did for many of us back in Georgia.
Japaridze and I have known each other for many years, since she came from the former, well, it had stopped being the former Soviet Union then, from Georgia and Moscow, and moved here to New York. And we've often in the past discussed Stalin, and not in an admiring way, but to try to put him in perspective, because he's often seen in caricature terms. And that was where we had a point of common ground. it seems that a lot of his political opponents wanted to denigrate Stalin's intellect, motives easily impugned, but his intellect and his talents, in particular in America, the view of him was colored by Trotsky and his followers, who have persuaded many liberal social democratic Americans that Trotsky was in fact a cozy democratic socialist, when in fact all the evidence shows that he and Stalin were really in competition to see who could be there in the execution chamber pulling the trigger up till then. But it was that sense of appreciation of looking at, looking at the three dimensions, that we found quite a lot of common ground, especially in Montefiore's Young Stalin, which was an objective consideration and gave, let's say, full talent, full credit to where Stalin's strengths, at no point condoning his somewhat amoral behavior. So that was when I heard that Tinatin was doing a book on Stalin's reception. I thought, this is perfect, because in Georgia, Stalin is still a hero. This was a souvenir mug that I got in Georgia. The Georgians don't like Russians, but they like Stalin, because Stalin isn't Russian. He's a Georgian as far as they're concerned. Of course, in Russia, lots of people like Stalin, but hate Georgians. And everything bad he does is blamed on the fact that he was Joe the Georgian. So it's interesting to see how this goes, because with Putin calling for the denazification of Ukraine, it's interesting that there's never been a complete de-Stalinization in the Soviet Union. They took his statues down, they took the banners down, but people treasure these relics in the back. The statue is still up in Georgia, I think, but that's a tribute to Georgian patriotism rather than to Stalin's reputation. So here we have a country that's really based on Stalin and Lenin before, because, you know, we often blame Stalin for things that, once again, because of the peculiar schismatic politics on the left in Western Europe, Trotsky is exonerated and Stalin is blamed. And basically, it was all Lenin. They were all pretty much ruthless, murderous, undemocratic people. But that legacy still lingers. And I think we're seeing now the effects of the lack of de-Stalinization in Russia, in terms of the politics, in terms of sending conscripts through on exercises that just happened to trip across the border into the next country, the breathtaking cynicism on the last gasp, because we're going to have possibly his grandson later in the week or next week, Alexander Gorbachev even. When it came to Georgia and there was dissidents, he sent the troops in. When it came to Chernobyl, they just lied about it, didn't tell people that they were facing it. And these are straight out of the Stalin era. You ration how much information is available for people and make sure it's the only information. So, Tinitin, when you went to Russians and you say, you know, I'm a Georgian, what do you think about Stalin? How did that color their response? Did your origins in any way affect them?
So I will just preface my answer to you with a very brief comment on your very compelling comment regarding Georgia viewed through the prism of a Russian and vice versa. So as you said, Georgians don't like Russians, but I would actually be very specific and say Georgians don't like the Russian government at the moment. However, fortunately, the relations between Georgian people and Russian people have, although been very complicated, somehow survived this very tumultuous period in time, both the Soviet era as well as the post-Soviet era, that has not been any easier, to be perfectly frank. The transition has been rather tumultuous for both sides. So in that respect, talking to Russians has always been very easy for me when we agree that we sort of agree on the same values. They find the same problems to be problematic as well. Another aspect that made these conversations for me a little bit easier, and I suppose made me a little bit more palatable to the Russians, to the Russian people, was the fact that I spent my formative years in Moscow. And aside from the fact that I speak fluent Russian, I also understand some of the sort of the psychosocial cultural nuances of what makes Russians tick and what makes Russians tick vis-a-vis Georgians. And I hate to generalize because, of course, not all Russians are the same, just like not all Russians vote for Putin, even though Putin wants us to think that they do. But having said that, there is that sense of either nostalgia or some sort of longing for the relationship that we had in the Soviet era when Georgia really was the Côte d'Azur of many Soviets, not just of Russians. And there is that sense of affinity, and they miss it, and they miss being able to tap into that Georgian hospitality that was always there for them and that was always very welcoming. So I never really feel any animosity from Russians when I talk to them about these topics, but I do get very mixed signals from them, because obviously very few Russians living in Putin's Russia today are comfortable talking about what they really think and what they really feel. And when you ask them to tell you how they feel about Stalin, even though the Levada polling center numbers tell you one thing, that, you know, there's this sort of soaring popularity of Stalin and it's very disturbing, and that, you know, he's getting more and more popular as opposed to vice versa, his popularity going down because people have had a chance to really reflect on what actually happened during his reign. I do take those numbers, those statistics, with a grain of salt, because at the end of the day, yes, the questions that are being posed to the Russian people by Levada and the likes of Levada are, in hindsight, supposed to be a little bit easier for them to talk about because it was so long ago, and they should be less concerned about getting a knock on the door at 4 o'clock in the morning, dragging them out of their homes and taking them to the gulag. But we're seeing today, in, you know, knowing what we know about what's happening in Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine and everything else surrounding that conflict, that war, that perhaps not so much has changed that we thought had changed, actually. So the questions that were asked of the Russian people about what they thought about Stalin seemed like, oh, these are questions about something that happened 50 years ago, so clearly they will be comfortable talking about it. I am not so sure now, Ian, that these people are comfortable talking honestly and telling us truly what they think. So yes, the conversations have been very compelling. I have had a great deal of very interesting feedback from the Russians as well as the Georgians whom I interviewed for my book. But I did try to see through those numbers and read between the lines of the statistics beyond what meets the eye.
Well, I mean, it's not the knock on the door now, but it would be a very brave dissident who went within umbrella range.
Yes.
Of somebody exactly. Looking official. I mean, I took it to the iconic pictures of Putin at one end of a football stadium sized table and his advisors at the other. And I derive from this that that must be the effective range of an umbrella dart. And that's why he's maintaining that distance. I mean, there's that paranoid fear of which, yes. You know, it's not the overt. He's not using the vocabulary of Stalin, but he's still using the same effects. People disappear. Things happen to people.
Things
and
happen.
Of course, exactly. Demonstrators are arrested and that reinforces your point about Russian people, that thousands of them are prepared to come out and demonstrate and risk imprisonment and police assaults. But it's at least it's not the KGB with machine guns yet.
Yet. And hopefully it will stay that way.
Yeah, even the behavior of the Russian troops in Ukraine is interesting. In the old days, there would have been a battalion of KGB with machine guns behind them. They would not be stalled in a convoy. They'd be going ahead into a minefield if ordered, because you face the uncertainty of death in front of you and the certainty behind. But how does this reflect? Because this gets back to people, you know, people like discipline, they think. You know, in the old days, it was good. You know, it's the same in most countries. Yeah, Churchill wouldn't have stood for this, and Churchill would have shown them. Stalin would have shown them. And you know, there is a horrible atavistic desire for authoritarian, authoritative rule that often gets disguised as authoritarian. And looking at the chaos in Russia with the mafia and the bribable police and all the rest of it, you can see where there's room for some type of nostalgia. Does that figure into the equation?
Yes, I certainly do. It does. I certainly do think that it does. And quite frankly, the very notion of talking about nostalgia for the Soviet period about 5-10 years ago would have been very sort of quiche and very, you know, we're not really going to talk about it, because who's actually going to take nostalgia seriously through the prism of where we are today? But quite frankly, based on the conversations that I've had, based on the research that I've done, both in and outside of the archives and actual conversations with people in various parts of that part of the world, showed me that nostalgia does play into this, even if they don't think about it as nostalgia. It's sort of subconscious in a way, because there are certain things that are genuinely missed of that period, and there are other things that are reflected upon in hindsight with a bit of fondness, because as we know, nostalgia is really as longing for something that perhaps never was. So of course, many aspects of that nostalgia are very misleading, not only for us on the receiving end when we talk about nostalgia to those on the ground, but also for those who are thinking about nostalgia, what they're nostalgic for. They might be remembering the first time they tried a certain kind of Soviet ice cream that made them feel extremely nostalgic when they thought about it. And they thought, oh, I really miss those times. It's got very little to do with the times, with the external elements, and perhaps a lot to do with the taste of that ice cream. And obviously, I'm simplifying, oversimplifying.
Asparagus.
Exactly, right. But yes, this does play into it. And I suppose because, and of course, I'm no psychologist, but I did have a dual degree in psychology, was a double major. I did think about these things a lot about, you know, what do we think, but actually in reality, what is going on in our minds? Because we may think that we're nostalgic, but we may be feeling something entirely different. For example, paranoia, and as a way of protecting ourselves, this sort of self-protection, one of the ways that we can defend ourselves is by thinking fondly about those times, as opposed to really thinking about the paranoia and the terror, which will make us feel all the more terrified and all the more horrified by everything that is happening at the moment and make us feel all the more uncomfortable. So there are certainly many, many aspects of every single concept that I try to unpack in my book. So the three elements in Stalin's millennials that I try to grapple with are nostalgia, nationalism, and trauma. And I think all three of these concepts have, if not three, at least two sides, sort of a flip side to each. And I would urge my reader, as well as myself, when thinking about some of these topics, to understand that it's not really as black and white as one might think on the book cover.
Now, Stalin has a particular relationship with Ukraine in the triangle here, because yeah. You know, it I'm sure there are a lot of Soviet nostalgias who remember the great days of repelling the Nazis, etc., etc.
Yes.
And what is the, how does this work with the Ukrainians? Because there's also the alternative narrative in Ukraine of the famine and the purges and the collectivization, which undoubtedly caused millions of deaths in the countryside in Ukraine. Whether it was specifically anti-Ukraine or just general anti-peasants is another story.
Yes, yes. And even from Putin's perspective today, I do feel that Putin does see Ukraine as a country that is in Russia's backyard, immediate backyard, to the point where I would even challenge the use of the word country. And with all due respect to my Ukrainian friends, and please understand that I'm not saying this in a derogatory manner, I'm addressing my Ukrainian friends, but rather as sort of coming from Putin's perspective, I don't honestly feel that he thinks of Ukraine as a sovereign country. I do think that just like when talking about Ukraine, you can either say in terms of the preposition used in Ukraine is na Ukraine. That's how Russians will continue to say this. And you can tell right away when you're watching the coverage of the ongoing war, whether they say na Ukraine or v Ukraine. So in English, I think the comparative here is going to be basically in Ukraine versus in the Ukraine. So in the Ukraine is the equivalent of na Ukraine. And that is a way of talking about a territory that is basically a province, part of something broader that Putin and his cronies feel that is and should be and should continue being in Russia's, within Russia's immediate influence. Before the war, I would have talked about this in sort of more esoterical terms, in terms of the influence vis-a-vis soft power. But now I think we can make a very confident claim that he also thinks about Ukraine to be within Russia's immediate influence in terms of the geographical territory and military and all the rest of it. He thinks that he is reclaiming what he believes is Russia's property. And that is extremely disturbing. And that is one of the narratives that does sort of echo that Stalinist approach, except at the time, we were all part of the Soviet Union, whether we liked it or not. We were occupied by the Soviet Union, by official Moscow, so to speak. And that was something that we had to deal with and had to learn to exist with. Whereas today, over 30 years after the collapse of that Soviet Union, Putin is trying to rebuild something very similar. Perhaps we can't call it Soviet Union 2.0. I actually would urge us not to think about it in such simplistic terms, but there are very clear actions, no longer just words, but actual actions that Putin and his apparat are taking that are showing us that they still see Ukraine and Georgia too, to a degree, to be exactly what we were in the Soviet times. We are now being treated as Russia's official Moscow's provinces.
But I mean, the irony here, of course, is that Stalin's major contribution to Marxist-Leninist theory was the national question. It was the issue on which he made his paper that came into, that brought him to Lenin's attention. Yes. And he's responsible for a lot of the fairly deranged boundaries which laid, I mean, the question is whether he was following a particular formula or whether, as many people suspect, he was deliberately putting divide and conquer tactics in, you know, with enclaves of one and another, with parts of Uzbekistan and in Tajikistan, if I remember, and the boundaries were made to divide in a very serious way, regardless of the people there. So Abkhazia, Ossetia, these are all legacies of Stalin's doctrine on nations, and everyone is rigidly adhering to them. So to what extent is that legacy really there? And Stalin also put Ukraine and Belarus into the United Nations and claimed they were sovereign countries,
That's right.
Putin seems to be rather forgetting now.
Absolutely. And I'm already starting to see some of the questions that our viewers are submitting. And thank you so much for those. And please keep them coming. One of the questions was, in fact, about Stalin's perspective on Ukraine. And Ian, I was actually going to make this very point as one of my arguments, that if we think about even Stalin's way of looking at Ukraine, just the very fact that Ukraine became part of the United Nations Security Council, and that was something that Stalin fought for. Now, obviously, this played straight into his hand, and he just wanted as much power within the United Nations Security Council as he could get. And obviously, Ukraine and Belarus were both under the Soviet Union, so to speak, jurisdiction.
I don't believe there was a single recorded vote in which they voted against.
Right, right, exactly. But even so, just even on paper, that was a very different stand to what we're seeing Putin make at the moment vis-a-vis Ukraine. And that's actually very scary to me, because if 5-6 months ago I could have told someone, sort of rhetorically asked the question, how much worse could it get than what we lived through in the Soviet times? Mm-hmm. Now you sort of wonder, 5-6 months later, I don't know if that rhetorical question still holds.
But it's not as unprecedented as we think. I mean, what's been happening in Ukraine happened in Chechnya, and the West didn't bat an eyelid.
Absolutely. You
can picture the center of Grozny, and the sad bit is you can see the future of Kyiv and the Kharkiv there.
Yes.
So the idea of accepting nationality doesn't mean to say you had to accept that they actually had independence.
Independent, right. That's a very good point.
I mean, I keep thinking in terms of I think London should make a determined bid to reconquer Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the other places, as close as lips and teeth, as the Chinese might say, because the claim is every bit as good as the Chinese claim to Taiwan or the Russian claim to Ukraine.
Well, please don't give Turkey any of these ideas, because as you remember, Georgia was also one, and Georgia as well. We were under Turkey's control for a very long time, and Russia supposedly, quote unquote, liberated us, much like Soviet Russia also liberated.
I don't believe the Tartars looked at it that way even then. And, of course, they didn't get a vote about Crimea, even... because they were all deported in 1941 and never to return. In fact, I understand the Russian authorities in Crimea are still arresting Tartars.
Yes.
Protesting and asking for their rights as the indigenous people on the territory.
Absolutely.
And that was another way of Stalin's legacies, of course, you could regard it as the Procrustean approach. If you remember Procrustes, he had the bed and travelers were invited to lie in it. If they were too short, they were stretched on the rack, and if they were too long, they had the legs lopped off.
I didn't know that.
Oh, this is what I call his Procrustean approach to nationalism.
You live, you learn.
If the people don't fit the nation, then you have to cut them to make sure they do.
Oh my goodness!
It wasn't just Stalin. I think that's a characteristic of rabid nationalism everywhere.
Absolutely.
When you decide that one nation, one country, one language. Which is basically what Stalin defined it in his national question. It's still a working definition, but somewhat inflexible, as you might have guessed from the character.
Absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. One question here is, what's the difference between Ukraine versus Georgia? And
how much time do I have? Because that's quite a question. And in fact, I'm working on co-writing an article as we speak, which should probably be out more than likely tomorrow. I'm co-writing with Natia Gambrelidze, who is a fellow Georgian. She's a fellow at Harvard's Davis Center. And Natia and I spent many sleepless nights over the past few days thinking about these very questions and thinking about these very arguments that we're trying to make, sort of comparing Georgia and Ukraine in the current, sort of through the current prism of Putin's actions in Ukraine vis-a-vis his actions in 2008 in Georgia. And just to give you a sense of what those arguments are without giving too much away, because I would love for you all to read our article that Natia and I are
writing. Please send us the link and we'll circulate it.
We certainly will. There's certainly sort of one of the components that we have to think about. Now, from Putin's mind, obviously, is that these two wars, we tend to talk about them, particularly in the Western media, so to speak, in the US and Western Europe, as 2008 explains what is happening in 2022. Natia and I don't actually think that is true, and we feel that it is quite misleading and limiting for our argument for it to be viewed solely through that prism. One difference that comes to mind, obviously, let's just talk very briefly about the economic factor. Obviously, the Georgia market is much, much smaller and, you know, far less attractive for Russia than Ukraine is, which is a very sort of crucial commodity player, as we know. In terms of the sort of the public consumption of talking about the war and how Putin tries to talk about the war in Ukraine versus the war in 2008, one of the biggest differences in the narrative is sort of this presentation of Russia's quote unquote, military operations as sort of denazification and demilitarization of Ukraine, and therefore a significant sliver of what Russia and what the Kremlin views as Ruski Mir, so the Russian world. Putin never was naive enough to view Georgia through that prism of, you know, Georgia being part of the Ruski Mir. There is also sort of this belief that, at least in Putin's worldview, that his core beliefs have remained intact, yet external and internal factors do play into influencing opinions and shaping assumptions that have not been entirely static. So there's a domestic component that I'll talk about briefly. Putin was enjoying far more popularity in Russia domestically, even though he was no longer president. Let me just remind us all, on paper, he was prime minister, but nevertheless, we all know that he was running the country and, you know, pushing all the way
from Milosevic to switch the presidency, yes, and the prime ministership as, yes, as it suits, as term limits required.
Absolutely. But he was far more popular in Russia and far more confident in his popularity in Russia in 2008 than he is in 2022, even before the invasion. And I think that factor we need to think about very closely, because just as an example, if we think about South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the fact that Russia declared their independence, I would say, I think it was 2 weeks, exactly 2 weeks after the end of the five-day war in August of 2008. So it took them 2 weeks to declare South Ossetia's and Abkhazia's independence and sort of proclaim to the world that, you know, we now grant them independence and they're sovereign, they're free of Georgia. In the Donbas region, we are seeing something very different. Obviously, with Donetsk and Luhansk, I will be very specific because Luhansk suggests that I'm on the Russian side of the argument, which I am not. We are seeing something very different. This actually was done 2 days prior to the invasion. So one could argue there was no need in order to help these two territories claim their, declare their independence in Russia's and the world's eye for Putin to go right into Ukraine proper. Even by his standards, even though Donetsk and Luhansk are very much part of Ukraine, in Putin's mind, they are not. However, when you're rolling your tanks into Kharkiv and into Kyiv, I'm sorry, but we're no longer talking about a disputed territory here. This is Ukraine's sovereign territory, something that even Putin himself believed in, or at least so he claimed, just a few days before invading the Ukrainian proper territory. So there are many, many differences, and I will be certain to circulate the link to my analysis together with Natia about where we see those differences. And of course, we talk about the similarities too, because those cannot be discounted. But I would urge us to think about these wars very differently and also understand that it was a very different Putin in 2008, and we are witnessing a very different Putin who is also visibly very disturbed and paranoid about everything that is unraveling, because I don't think, in response to one of the questions from our audience members, that Russia actually knew what it was getting itself into. I don't believe that the Kremlin knew exactly what they were getting themselves into.
So you think they were prisoners of their own propaganda? They were in their own ideological bubble, that the Ukrainians were full of Russian speakers just groaning for liberation?
Absolutely. And I do think that Russia, official Russia, very naively expected there to be a very similar tepid reaction to the war in Ukraine, similar to what we saw in Georgia in 2008, because yes, there was support from the international community, and we, the Georgians, are very grateful for that support. However, in comparison to how the entire world, minus several countries that are either siding with Russia or are sort of playing the Swiss card, even though the Swiss aren't playing that card either, they're not being neutral. In Georgia, we saw something very, very different. And again, we are by no means under any illusion as Georgians that we are of the same interest economically, militarily, security-wise, etc., to the world in terms of geopolitics. So we do understand that. But this also speaks volumes about, after this war, irrespective of how it ends, do we think that Putin will try to replay this playbook in Georgia again? I don't think, knowing what we know today on the seventh day of the war in Ukraine, that this will be the case. Perhaps on the first day of the war, many of my Georgians were deeply concerned that this playbook would get reused and replayed in our country, in Georgia. Fortunately, with the way that the international, everyone really, I was going to say the international community, but I would say the majority of everyone out there, the way they've spoken up and they've stood up for what they see as being on the right side of history, that I think will help us Georgians massively. And I truly wish that our response to Ukraine from the Georgian government side could have been a little less tepid. I was personally I was disappointed. I do understand that there is a sense of paranoia, and of course, we don't want to further irritate the already dangerous, extremely dangerous Russian bear. But by the same token, I don't think this will help Georgia's case vis-a-vis some of our sort of pro-Western goals and missions that we had set for ourselves, because this makes us look a little bit weaker in terms of how we are not quite standing on the right side of history on the government's front. However, I will say that our president, Salome Zurabishvili, she did speak up, contrary to our prime minister, Irakli Garibashvili, who was far more tepid, and also the Georgian people have spoken. And this no one can deny. We have all seen the pictures, we have all seen the videos. The Georgian people are not echoing the Georgian prime minister's remarks. If anything, they are supporting the Ukrainian people more than any of us Georgians could have imagined. And I'm extremely proud to be Georgian as I watch the streets of Tbilisi from my apartment in Washington, D.C., because we are doing what we can as a country to stand on the right side of history and stand with our allies, because truly Ukraine is our ally. And we are not just saying that now because we have to appear to be in solidarity with them.
It's not just statecraft. As I understand it, the Georgian prime minister is in the pocket of a Russian kleptocrat. Financially, I don't expect you to comment on that because you have to go back there. But it's one of the reasons for his stupidity in the face of all of this.
Yes.
But the other part that comes in is, once again, the myths from the Stalin era. Stalin as the victor of World War II. Mm-hmm. And very much this is true. But I keep having to remind people that maybe World War II would not have happened if Stalin hadn't signed the Hitler-Stalin Pact in 1939 and invaded Poland and Finland and the Baltics. So, when we talk about the defense, et cetera,
yes,
perspective and history is called for. So we can get an all-round view. But the particular myth and the use of it, I'd like you to comment on, is the idea prevalent amongst many Western leftists that the Ukrainians are all neo-Nazis, waiting to wave the swastika and shout Heil Hitler. And this is coming from people who have just missiled the Babi Yar Memorial. They're the ones who are coming out with these myths. They are bombing Kharkiv, which is, as I understand it, mostly a Russian-speaking city. Although I saw many videos of people saying they're never going to speak Russian again when they're disgusted at what's happening. But these myths have traction in the West. The sort of it's not just the ghost of Stalin, but the ghost of the Third International is wandering amongst anti-imperialists and leftists and third worldists, because somehow they think that the Comintern is they associate Putin with the alleged glory days of the Russian Revolution, when in fact he is a blatant kleptocrat, a multi-billionaire.
Yes, this is very true, and it's extremely offensive. And I am not Jewish, although I often say to my Jewish friends who are Jewish that actually I do feel like I'm a Jewish girl trapped in a Georgian woman's body. And it's extremely painful and extremely offensive, not just to those of us who know what we sort of lived through and what people lived through under Hitler. Let's not talk about Stalin for a moment. Let's talk about Hitler and actual Nazi Germany and the Nazi regime. And then when you talk about denazification of Ukraine, this is deeply, deeply offensive on so many levels. One does not have to be Jewish to be offended. I am very deeply offended by this, and sort of using this, like many other justifications for his actions, normally I would have said his policies, but now we're seeing his actions, actual actions, is extremely disturbing. And history, as we know, of course, this is no secret, but Vladimir Putin is extremely good at using and manipulating history. Extremely good at it. He knows his history, contrary to what some could have said a few days ago when he made his sort of revisionist history lecture/statement on Russian television that we all watched in disbelief. I actually wanted my money back for all of the history courses that I had taken just for a moment. It's so disturbing because he knows better. Of course he knows history. And of course he knows what's right and what's wrong and what happened versus what did not happen. This is not just a version or a slight manipulation of history. This is blatant abuse of history as mankind has known it. And there were certain things and certain historical events that everyone, the entire world, has agreed upon, and we are on the same page. There is actual consensus when we talk about the 20th century on many, many aspects of our very disturbing history. And now suddenly he is telling his nation, and of course not just his nation, but the entire world, that all of this is a lie, and he's offering this sort of revisionist take on absolutely everything we've known thus far to be a lie. And he's sort of preaching the gospel, this revised history through the prism of Putinism. And I find that extremely disturbing. And much like many people find the use of the term military operations.
I've got to show this. It's in parallel to the Stalin mug. It's for cleaning the smell out of toilets. It was sent to me. It was several years ago. So it's not an ad hoc reaction, but it's over 500 applications in every bottle to clean the smell out. Putin. And you know the fact that he has rapidly become almost a figure of derision, because he has shown a lack of attachment to reality. It's almost like Stalin, who didn't believe the Germans were actually attacking, or didn't believe his spies who told him the attack is coming. They gave him the date. The British gave him the date, and he refused to believe it. The Germans attacked, and he still refused to believe it. So is Putin in this state of delusion? Does he really think the Ukrainians are waiting with bouquets and flowers and chocolates for the invading armies?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. I think every psychologist on the planet is trying to figure that out. Is he actually delusional, or is he just completely on a different planet at this point? I think it's something right in the middle. So a few months ago, we could have argued that as problematic as his policies were, that he was quite predictable, that everyone kind of knew what he wanted. We knew what he was going to do. We did not like it, but he was predictable. And that was very helpful to us, right? Because when we were sort of analyzing what was happening in Russia and what it considers to be its vicinity, its sort of backyard, again, as Putin likes to sort of quote unquote call it, exactly, the near abroad. At the same time, we knew, we could tell what he was going to do at any given point in time. We cannot do that anymore. I would go so far as to say that those in his immediate vicinity who are working with Putin don't also know what to expect from him, because based on what we're hearing from Moscow and from the various corridors in the Kremlin and beyond, sort of in hushed whispers, is that many of those who thought they knew what he was going to do, nobody knows. Even his cronies don't really know what he's going to do next, because very few, if anyone, and if anyone tells you that they absolutely knew that he was going to invade Ukraine proper, I think they might be lying, because no one could tell, even a few days prior to the invasion, that he was going to go quite this far. And the fact that he is so unpredictable, and therefore it is also very unstable, and he's becoming unstable and very difficult to read, is for perhaps even more disturbing than the fact that we can't read him. The fact that the Russians who work for him cannot read him scares me, because we don't know what he's going to do tomorrow. And I sincerely, on a personal note, don't think that, I don't believe that I could have predicted that he could have gone in as far as he did. But now that he's in, it's very hard to get out. And I think he knows that there is a little bit of a dead end. Now that he's all the way in, he has tapped into something that it's going to be very difficult to get out of there. And even if hypothetically, and one of the questions I think was about the, can we anticipate him winning this war and sort of reclaiming Ukraine? I don't think he can claim Ukraine perfectly, frankly, but at the same time, even if he were to win this war, whatever winning the war means, it will be very difficult for him to continue business as usual in Moscow on a domestic level as well. For him to continue justifying his moves, continue to getting the approval ratings, continue getting the votes, because he's got his eyes set on 2024. And even if one meddles with the votes here and there, you know, shaves off a few ballots here and there, at the end of the day, yes, it was highly inflated in terms of the results in the prior elections, but not to the extent that we cannot say that he still kept winning those elections. To a degree, whether it was the same percentage that he was selling to the public and the world, he was still able to stay in power. What will happen to him now when all is said and done? Obviously, if Russia loses the war,
is less than a cent to the dollar.
Yes, exactly. And then that's also very scary, because there's a lot of mouths to feed. And how do you feed those mouths?
It's happened before. We did it first. Western economists went in there and crashed the economy, or suggested to Gorbachev that he crashed the economy.
Yes.
So the Russian people have been there before, but they thought presumably this was behind them.
I thought everything was behind us as well. To be honest, when I started writing this book a couple of years ago, I thought it was so highly unlikely that I would ever have to think about Stalinism ever again. I thought I'll write this book and then I never have to think about it, because I've sort of been dwelling on these topics for so long, and I could get it out of my system and be done with it and move on with my day-to-day job at the critical mass worrying about security today. That is not the case. We now have to rethink so much, and we have to rethink so much that we thought was true and so much that we thought was going to be the case moving forward, that when, once again, all is said and done, it is not just going to be difficult for Russia to move on. It is not just going to be very difficult, first and foremost, of course, for Ukraine, reparations, et cetera, but also for all of us this side of the Atlantic as well. We have to rethink so much, and we have to reassess so much moving forward. That is what's most disturbing to me, because at the moment we're still in that euphoria of we have to refresh our Twitter feeds to see what's happening at this very moment in Ukraine. But at some point very, very soon, I think a lot will be different. Perhaps not everything, but a lot will be different, and the world will be very different from the kind of world that we went to sleep in the day before, the night before the invasion on this side of the Atlantic.
Now, Putin and his cabal have been they've wrapped themselves in the glory of what you might consider Stalin's achievement with the Great Patriotic War, the parades, and they've accepted all the victories. Has Putin ever addressed the question of Stalin and the relationship? Was Stalin a goodie or a baddie? Or, you know, which was it? Has he come out with a balanced assessment, or is he just being quiet about it in case anyone makes the connection?
Well, he was very quiet about it for a very long time. And you can only imagine, Ian, the amount of research I had to do on that very topic for my book, because for the Georgian case, there's sort of the two Stalins of Montefiore, the Georgian Koba and the Russified Soviet Red Tsar. For those two Stalins, it's very clear. And obviously, Montefiore has done such fantastic work that there was absolutely no point in trying to find anything new. But for that third Stalin that I tried to grapple with in my narrative, was...
Explain that not everybody will have read it. This is the book on the young Stalin, which traced his origins as Koba. And, you know, I've always said he was the working class kid made good from Georgia. And I think the Bolsheviks were very snobbish about it. They're quite happy for him to go and rob trains and banks to keep them in exile and comfort in Europe. But then they scorned him afterwards. And that's part of the history of the 20th century. He paid back for that scorn, obviously.
Absolutely. When I was thinking about that third Stalin, I really wanted to see how does the post-Soviet Georgia and post-Soviet Russia, obviously two very different governments and very different regimes, how they try to tackle the Stalin question, whether it's explicit or subtle. In Georgia, Stalin is talked about through that personal prism, right? As you very well pointed earlier, Ian, we're sort of in a very bizarre way, in a very morbid way, proud of Stalin because he was one of ours. He had them, the Russians, right? Sort of, you know, he put us on the map and then he paid them back for all of the grievances without actually realizing that it was Russia under Stalin that put us through what it put us through. In many aspects, of course, there's that Russian imperial factor as well that's going to take us down the rabbit hole of history, so I won't go there now. So he is talked about personally. And sort of that pride, very few people will tell you I'm ashamed that Stalin was Georgian in Georgia. They will mostly talk about all of the negative, but also very quietly and in a very subtle way, let you know that in some bizarre way, we are quietly proud of the fact that he was one of ours.
Well, Russians are proud of Ivan the Terrible. They didn't mind.
Well, they are. They are. Many, many Russians I know who are very sensible people are proud of him. And in Russia, the narrative generally has revolved around the Great Patriotic War, right? So that's something that's talked about much more than Stalin per se when we talk about the positive connotations. And Putin was very, very subtle at the beginning. There's many different Putins, obviously. If I think there's three Stalins, there's probably about 15 Putins at this point, part of the Matryoshka.
Personality disorder.
Yes, there's many, many layers. He was very subtle at the beginning. And as he sort of progressed and as he became more and more confident on the one hand in his power and his popularity, and on the other hand, whenever there were some hurdles that Russia had to overcome in order for the Kremlin to keep sort of its claws on the society and ensure that they don't lose that tight grip that they had on Russia as a whole, Stalin and the Great Patriotic War were used in multiple different ways, multiple iterations to tap into certain territories that were long forgotten. And there have been instances, and I talk about it in the book, and this is another plug, if you want to read more about it, you're going to have to buy the book. Yes, by the way, Stalin's Millennials can be ordered everywhere online, including on Amazon, but also Roman and Littlefield's website, my publisher's website. I tried to show actual examples from actual speeches that both Vladimir Putin, but also Dmitry Medvedev, when he was in power for that very short period of time as Russia's president, has made certain points about Stalin. And those two points between Dmitry Medvedev and Vladimir Putin, as much as they are on the same page in many ways, when it comes to Stalin, they differ. And they talk about Stalin very, very differently. And now if you want to know how, you're going to have to pick up the book. Shameless plug.
A cliffhanger.
Yes.
Well, Tinatin, it looks like, thank you for this I think it's this is the type of depth which most people are missing with the caricatures of brave Ukrainians. In fact, one issue that's already come up is the Ukrainian alleged treatment by not the Ukrainian government, I must add, but Ukrainian citizens of the third world refugees, the Africans in particular, who have been thrown off trains to make way for real Ukrainian refugees, etc., which has not exactly redounded to the credit of the Ukrainian cause, and especially in the third world where they're hovering anyway. Thank you for your depth and perception in this. And
thank you.
I should warn our guests out there that we are intending a tentatively Monday 11 o'clock. We're waiting for confirmation. But recently we had Nikita Khrushchev's granddaughter, because of her own outstanding merit, speaking. And next Monday, we're hoping to have Alexander Gorbachev of that ilk, I think the grandson, who was more prestigiously, perhaps, he was an awardee of the Foreign Press Association Scholarship in 2016 and is practicing as an editor and a writer, a filmmaker in Moscow. And he hopefully will be with us on Monday, World War III permitting. So look forward to seeing you. Watch this space for more. Watch this space for more details of Tinatin's publications, and watch this space generally, because we're trying to keep the foreign press and the world informed in three dimensions, not just two. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Foreign Press Association. And before I say goodbye, I just wanted to remind everyone that I am not Joseph Stalin's granddaughter, since you've got so many grandchildren of such leaders, that I am not Stalin's granddaughter. But thank you very much for your time. And I
what your grandmother was one of the victims of the purges, wasn't she?
My great aunt, exactly. She was actually one of the very direct victims of the NKVD chief of Mr. Beria.
So we know whereof we speak. Thanks again, Tinatin.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Everybody.